Well, for those of you who are visiting with us, we last Sunday really began a series attempting to explore the circumstances which contributed to the crisis and the conflicts resulting in the arrest, the trial, and the execution of Jesus of Nazareth. That's what we're attempting to do for the next few weeks. Last week, we agreed that we thought that Jesus would not mind being remembered as a fighter. Remember that? We came to pretty well a consensus that he would not object to being remembered as a fighter, with this qualification, as a fighter for people. I think he would be honored for us to remember him as a fighter for people. And so we came to that conclusion last week. This morning I want to draw some specifics about where it was that he specifically came in conflict with the reigning authorities of religion in his day. He came into conflict with them precisely at the point, and only at the point, where people were involved and were being abused. And that's a central thought that we must hang on to, because we're going to be looking at him, we're going to be looking at the plot, we're going to be looking at one particular type of incident in which he came into conflict with the religious leaders. And this is all being done in an attempt to help us understand why they killed him. And it's not just an exercise in some kind of intellectual thing. What we're trying to figure out is, what was there about him? What was there that so fixed him that he could not be swayed away from what he was doing, even in the face of it causing his death? What was it that he considered worth dying for? As we begin our trek to Golgotha, and that's what I'm going to call these next few weeks between now and Resurrection Sunday, March the 29th, known as Easter Sunday. It's the, I'm not sure exactly what year anniversary it is of his resurrection. We're going to be aiming at that weekend, and we're going to be calling it this trek toward Golgotha. On that occasion, we'll not be celebrating just his death, we'll be celebrating his resurrection. But as we begin our trek to Golgotha, if we were to begin where the road to Golgotha really began, we would have to go back millennia. We'd have to go back thousands of years, because it was predicted well in advance. This wasn't something that happened by chance. His death was not something that took everyone by surprise. This was the fulfillment of prophecies that date back thousands of years before he lived. We'd have to go all the way back to Genesis, the third chapter, and hear this vague, though it is there, it's vague, and yet it's very pronounced when you look at it from this end, when it was placed upon the serpent, a curse, that the heel of the seed of woman would bruise the serpent's head, and that the serpent's head would bruise the seed of woman's heel. There's no doubt in my mind that that is a reference to the coming of the Christ, the seed of woman, and this battle between him and the forces of evil. And then we could take that road, and all the way down the road through the thousands of years that followed, we would track and trail the blood. There's a trail of blood from animals, trail of blood from sheep that were slain year after year after year, month after month. Every year there was this annual slaying of a Passover lamb later. But until then, there was just this trail of blood that streaks all the way from Abel all the way down through the history of the Jewish people, and just through the history of people in general. It would bring us then to Psalms, the 22nd chapter, that startling chapter that begins, my God, why have you forsaken me? And it talks about him being able to see his bones, and how they pierced his hands and his feet, and how they divided his garments among them, and how that they gambled over his coat. All of that's in Psalms, the 22nd chapter. That was written a millennium before Jesus of Nazareth died. It's almost as though the psalmist were standing there on the hill recording the events that were taking place. And then it finds this trail. It runs all the way down through some pretty dark times. And then it climbs a mountain to a mountain peak of prophecy. And we hear Isaiah standing there saying, who has believed what we've heard? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant, like a root out of dry ground. He had no form nor comeliness. There was no beauty about him that we should desire him. He was a man of sorrows and was acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men turned their faces, he was despised. And we didn't recognize him. We thought he was stricken and smitten by God and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The transgression of my people it was that he suffered for. All we like sheep have gone astray. All, he said, we've turned everyone to our own way, and Jehovah has laid upon him the iniquity of us all. And from Isaiah's mountain peak experience, the road descends pretty well into a craggy, rough road down into the area of Babylon. And out of Babylon there comes this man named Daniel, who actually told the year. Look at Daniel the 9th chapter and read it. He gives the exact year when the Messiah would appear and would be executed. Daniel tells about it. And this road to Golgotha actually has a sign on it pointing, it shall be so many years before the Messiah comes. And he points to the future, to this great event, and says this is when it will happen. And he will be executed and the Messiah will have nothing. And then in that same frame in Zechariah, there's a statement made that in that day, I will pour out upon the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem a spirit of compassion and supplication, so that when they look on him whom they've pierced, they shall mourn for him as one mourns for an only child, and shall weep bitterly over him as one weeps over a firstborn. On that day there shall be a fountain opened for the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem to cleanse them from sin and uncleanness. So the road leads all the way from Adam. It leads all the way from Abel. It leads all the way through that bloody pathway, all into the Psalms, into the prophets, up the hill to Isaiah, and then down in the valley to Daniel and Zechariah. And then it brings us to where we are today as we look at this last chapter in this road to Golgotha. And it will lead us then eventually several weeks to his death and to his resurrection. Now, I want to give just a brief synopsis of the plot, a brief synopsis of the characters of the drama. The characters are simply two, other than the victims. The victims are the Jewish people who were under the oppressing hand of the religious leaders. But Jesus was one of the main characters, and then the ones who opposed him, his opponents, were one of the main characters. And it depends on who you were as to what you thought of Jesus. Now, that's not anything new. That's the same thing today. It depends on who you are as to what you say about him. As far as the common people were concerned, they thought of Jesus as a very non-violent, a very benevolent, a very gregarious, a very peaceable, a very congenial man. And they thought of him as a captivating teacher. The record says that on occasions they hung on his words. They hung upon his words. They were there just, that's what they thought of him. He so mesmerized them with his teaching. On another occasion it says they all focused upon him. And the word that's used there is the word for antenna. Antenidzo. They focused upon him. And they had their antennas up. They were so concentrated upon what he was saying. The common people looked upon him as that kind of a person. They looked upon him as a great, brave defender of the underdog. Now, he was a fighter. They looked upon him as somebody who would stand up for the underdog, someone they could depend on, someone they could go to, someone they could fly to for respite, for a reprieve, for redress. They looked upon him like that. But as far as the authorities were concerned, Jesus was a pain in the neck, if not lower in the anatomy. You know, he was a pain in the neck. They looked upon him as somebody who was a problem. In John's gospel account of it, he pictures them as the very first encounter that he had with the Jewish people. He flew in their face in the cleansing of the temple. Bam! There he was in their face, throwing people out of the temple, turning over money changers' tables, dumping out their treasures, running the sheep out, telling the ones that sold the doves, get those things out of here. How dare you make my father's house a house of merchandise? That's the way it starts off in John's gospel, just with a gasp. And that's the way they looked upon him, as a problem. They looked upon him as someone who was dangerous in his teachings. He was a nonconformist. He was a blasphemer. But when it comes right down to it, at the bottom line, why they executed him, they executed Jesus of Nazareth, whether they recognized it or not, but I think they did. They recognized him as someone who was a threat to their position, as a threat to the Jewish nation and to their position as leaders and people in authority. They were just plain people. As you look at who they were plain people in one sense. They were humans. They were the rulers of the Jewish people. They were people, but they were people in authority. And they were people who were in religious authority. Now you can get by with some people who are in authority, but when you mix authority with religious authority, you've got problems on your hands. These people were people who were solid, stable citizens. They weren't the rabble. They weren't the ones who were out robbing and stealing with a club. They did it through religion. They were the ones who were religious people. But they were looked upon. They had no other way of being judged. The people just simply, that's the way it was. They were the upstanding citizens of the country. They had power, religious, certainly power, religiously. Political power, they did it by stealth. They obtained political power through bribery. They obtained political power through chicanery, through manipulation, through any way they could. They did whatever they wanted. They had enough power to do what they wanted to do. And they had enough gall to do it, and then they had a little enough principle to cover it up with anything they could cover it. And I say that without, I don't want to be extremely critical of them. Louise and I were talking about it today. I said one of the main things I think that was wrong with them is that they were blind. They were blind. And Isaiah had prophesied about that. Prophesy, he said, even though they're blind, they can't see. They've got eyes, but they can't see. Jesus referred to it and said, you've got eyes, but you can't see. You've got ears, but you can't hear. You have hearts, but you can't perceive. And you know, we can be critical of these people. We can talk about them. But when it gets right down to it, there was something about them that just could not see it any different from the way it had already been. But to sum it up in a way that you and I can understand, as far as their being leaders with power among people, they themselves, in a sense, they're represented by the Nixon White House. Watergate was something that they were familiar with. They were in cover-up constantly. They were doing what they wanted to do. They were manipulating. They were doing all of this at the expense of people. They were the Nixon White House. They were our current day Washington politics, business as usual. And I say that with shame, and I'm embarrassed. They were our present day judicial system. They were lookers for loopholes. Jurisprudence had gone down the drain, and pure legality had been based upon loopholes. And that's where we are today in our Jewish system, in our jurisprudence today. We are a system that has deteriorated to the point that we no longer look for justice. We look for loopholes and will do whatever it is in our power to execute the loophole and ignore the justice. We are pretty well just like them. Well, the plot, what about the plot? Those are the characters. Let's not be too hard on them, but let's look at them straightforward. But what about the plot? The plot has four distinct miniature dramas. We're going to be tracking these four dramas, plus the fact that there was this insidious, blasphemous claim that this man kept making, that he was God among us, that he was God among them. But that's the overall theme of it. All of this had to do with who he claimed to be. As we'll notice in a few moments, who he claimed, he had the right to do what he did because of who he was. But these four miniature dramas within this major plot to assassinate the great teacher from Galilee, and all four of these dramas set him at variance with the authorities. All four of them alienated. Each one of these had the power to alienate this man because each one of them struck at one of the very vital chords of the Jewish nation, as we'll notice in just a moment. Here were the four mini dramas. The Sabbath violations, which we'll notice today. The ceremonial washings. Then the way that he associated with sinners. And then thirdly, the way he elevated Gentiles to the position of people. These four mini-dramas, they run all through this. Let's look this morning only at one of them. Jesus' Sabbath violations. And we'll have to see kind of how the Jewish leaders looked at it and then how Jesus looked at the Sabbath in order to understand either one of their motives and either one of their actions. There were six of these that are recorded. Matthew, the 12th chapter, records the plucking of the grain and the eating of the grain by his disciples, and the Pharisees were sitting there with their binoculars watching them and making sure, and there they saw them, they're doing it, they're eating. Those guys are eating the grain, they're rubbing it in their hands. And they accused him of breaking the Sabbath. Then in the 12th chapter also of Matthew, you have the man with the withered hand in the synagogue. And then in Luke 13, you have the woman who had scoliosis for 18 years. She was bent over so badly she couldn't lift herself up and had been that way for 18 years. And then in Luke 14, you have the man who had dropsy. And he was in the synagogue and Jesus healed him on the Sabbath. And then in John, the 5th chapter, you have the man at the pool of Siloam, of the pool of Bethesda. And you have him being healed on the Sabbath. And then in John, the 10th chapter, you have the blind man that was healed on the Sabbath. And all of these threw the fat in the fire. Every one of these six violations of the Sabbath day were what set Jesus at such odds with the Jewish people or with the Jewish leaders. Look for just a moment at how the Jewish leaders viewed the Sabbath. What did they think about the Sabbath? Do you know how the Jew felt about the Sabbath? This was one of the peculiar things about the Jewish nation. This was one of the things that set the Jewish nation apart as a special people. The other visible thing was the circumcision. Now, then there was the law and all the things that went with it. But these two were especially precious. They were especially peculiar. The Sabbath was peculiar to the Jewish nation. No other nation had a law that allowed people to rest one day a week. Only the Jews. This was a covenant between them and God. This was an arrangement that God made with them, and one of the reasons why they broke it so was that it was hard to train people to be different from what they were. They never had heard of anything like this before. There was never any other law that gave a person a day off during the week. Now this sounds strange to us when we today have usually a 5-day work week, and some of you work 4 days. You know, and you work maybe 12 hours a day for those 4 days, or 10 hours a day, probably 10 hours a day. But these people worked from sun up to sundown 7 days a week, week after week, month after month, year after year, until they finally were ground down into the ground, into the earth, and actually expired way prior to the time of their life expectancy. Life expectancy back during these times was so low that, well, it was sometimes in the 30s and 40s that the general average life expectancy. But why not? They worked from sun up to sundown every day that they lived. And then along comes this God that says, 6 days shall you labor. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shall you labor, but on the Sabbath day you shall set it aside and you shall not work. And that was one of those things that set the Jewish people apart as being peculiar. And there were many forces that were at work eroding that distinctiveness of the Jewish people. All of this, you see, had to do with their identity. You want to know how to make you mad as a wet hen? You want to know how to make you really up in arms? Tamper with who you are. Tamper with your identity. You want to know how to make the church absolutely blow sky high? Tamper with its identity. That's what was happening here. They were looking at this man as being one of those who was eroding the distinctive identity of the Jewish people There were a lot of forces doing that. For one thing, the Roman occupation. The Roman occupation in Jerusalem, in the whole of Israel. The Roman occupation forces were part of the influence that was causing the Jewish nation to just kind of deteriorate as far as their eliteness and as far as their specialness and as far as their being a people separate and apart. The Roman occupation forces. The Greek language, where many of the Jewish people in the world spoke Greek, this was brought about because of the dispersions. The Jewish people no longer lived in Israel. They no longer lived in what we call today Palestine. They lived all over the world, just like they do today. But it was not something. It was something that had come about so gradually, but was so pervasive. There were people all over the world, and it was getting to be more and more difficult to maintain the distinct identity that the Jewish people seemed to have to maintain in order to keep their identity intact. The dispersions, the Greek language, the customs. Herod had established in Jerusalem, had built a huge gymnasium. And that's where people went, and the men contended in the Greek games naked. And all of this was just such an embarrassment, and the Jewish distinctiveness, and they were so offended, they just couldn't stand it. And this was one of those distinctive natures or distinctive features that was being effaced. And then when this Jew, this one of their own sons, not to talk about Pilate, not to talk about Herod, and to say nothing about Caesar Augustus, to say nothing about any of these, here was one of their own sons who had the audacity to repeatedly, to blatantly, to consistently, and to intentionally break this most sacred day of the year for them. Every week it came around and it said, these people are God's people. This is their covenant. Just too much, and they had to do something about it. But that's how they viewed it. And don't be too hard on them. These people had been raised. This was the 1400th year. 14 centuries they had been keeping the Sabbath. And it was that peculiarity about them that they so treasured. Well, how did Jesus view the Sabbath? And did he really break it? Was he really a violent breaker? Perhaps if we can see how he viewed it, at least it will explain why he made such determined, insistent, aggressive, and flagrant violations of it. In the 12th chapter of Matthew, and the first 8 verses, there is a record there that I want us to refer to and then draw a lesson from that. In Matthew, the 12th chapter, we began to see into him, and we began to see into them, and understand why they were so insistent on keeping it and why he was so insistent on breaking it. At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. His disciples were hungry and began to pick some heads of grain and eat them. When the Pharisees saw this, they said to him, "Look, your disciples are doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath." He answered, "Haven't you read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? He entered the house of God, he and his companions, ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for them to do, but only for the priests. Or haven't you read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple desecrate the day and are yet innocent? I tell you that one greater than the temple is here. If you had known what these words mean, 'I desire mercy and not sacrifice,' you would not have condemned the innocent, for the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath." That's what he thought of the Sabbath day. I'm not going to explain what he meant by what David did. I don't know what his interpretation of that. He just threw it up to them as an inconsistency that they endorsed, and he was not doing anything any worse than David. Now, I'm not sure what his rationale there was for using David as an example. But I think it was just simply to say, this one that you hold up as a patriarch, didn't you hear what he did when he went into the temple or to the tabernacle and ate the bread of the presence? As though to say, you don't condemn him, why would you condemn me? And he said, furthermore, don't you know that the priests on the Sabbath day, when they come and offer up sacrifices and they do all this work, and it was work. And he said, yet they're innocent. But Jesus' attitude toward it was simply two things here. First of all, he tells why he did it. And then he tells why he had the right to do it. I want you to look at verses 6 and 8. And I want to look first at those two and tell you why he said he had the right to do it. And this is enough to curl your toenails. It's enough to just knock those people back. He said, "I tell you that one greater than the temple is here." Do you get that? One greater than the temple is here. And then in verse 8, "For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath." How's that for flying in your face? Someone greater than the temple is standing in front of you. Come on. That's right. And then the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. In other words, he can do anything he full well pleases with it. He's the Lord of it. And then in between those two, verse 7, if you had known what these words mean, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you wouldn't have condemned the innocent. You see what he was saying there? They misunderstood what the whole nature of the Sabbath was. They thought it was a punitive command, while all the time God meant it to be a redemptive command. They thought it was something that was a burden to bear, and all the time God meant for it something to be something that lifted the burdens. You see, they had come out of slavery. They'd come out of Egyptian bondage, and that's the background of the giving of the Sabbath. It was in commemoration of God's rest in the creation. It was also given as a commemoration of the Jewish people being delivered from Egypt. And he was saying to them, do you remember when you had to work 7 days a week and you had no rest? He said, it's not going to be like that for you. You're not going to be like that as a nation. You're going to rest 1 day a week. And in the book of Leviticus, where it gets down to the details, he says, not only shall you not work, but neither shall your son, nor your daughter, nor your maidservant, nor your manservant, nor the foreigner who is in your land. There will be no one required to work. And he uses this expression, so that they also may rest. That's how Jesus looked at this. It was something that God intended to be an expression of mercy and an expression of generosity. You're not going to work in it. You're not going to work. But he said also, even your own slaves, the people that you think you own, the ones that work for you, the ones that slave for you, and even the foreigner, nobody's going to work on this day. It's a day of rest. But the reason why he broke the Sabbath was because of the fact he wanted them to understand you're missing the whole point. The Jewish leaders missed the purpose of the Sabbath. The Sabbath was intended to be an expression of mercy. And that's why Jesus said, if you'd only known what these words mean, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you wouldn't have condemned the innocent. Now, a lesson for us. What is the lesson for us? The Jewish leaders had a false view of the law. That's what Jesus implies here. If you'd only understood what the purpose of the Sabbath was. You see, they had the Sabbath as a punitive measure. God intended it as a redemptive measure. They had it as a way of punishing people. You can't do that on Saturday. God had it as a healing, as a refreshing expression saying, you don't have to work. What a difference there is to say, you can't do that. You can't carry that. And they had such things that you couldn't comb your hair on Saturday because you'd find a gray hair and you'd want to pull it out and that would be work. And that you couldn't eat an egg laid on Saturday. It takes work to lay an egg. Really? Now you couldn't eat the egg laid on a Saturday, but they had a way of getting around it. And there's so many loopholes that they looked. There were thousands of loopholes. You couldn't carry enough ink any more than enough to write so much, and you couldn't travel but 7/8 of a mile. All of these restrictions that kept the people just going, you know, are we doing something wrong? And what is it that? And what can't I do next? And all. Goodness alive. I think one of the loopholes, if you ate the egg late on the Sabbath, you had to kill the hen the next day. Things like that. Just dumb things. Traditions that we look at and say, you're serious, you're kidding, aren't you? No. But then I look at some of our traditions, and I think, uh-oh. We're a lot like them. We misunderstand the purpose of God. We misunderstand His nature. You know, you can't understand God right and misunderstand His law. In fact, the way you perceive of God determines what you perceive of His law. And the way you look at His law reflects how you look at God. And guess what else? The way you look at God determines the way you treat other people. And that's where they fell down. And that's where they got caught with Jesus of Nazareth. Because when he saw their misunderstanding, when he saw their misrepresentation of God, you see, whenever the law of the Sabbath was perceived to be something that was a hard burden to bear, and that there was this strong iron fist over the people, whenever that was what was portrayed as the law, that's what the people saw God as being. And when Jesus saw this misrepresentation of God and then saw this mistreatment, maltreatment of the people, he simply would not tolerate it. And he stood up in their face and he simply said, "You're not going to treat people like that. And if you do, it will be over my dead body." And the people loved it. They loved it. In one case where the woman that had scoliosis, she couldn't raise up for 18 years, he brought her up in front of the people and he said to the woman, he said, you're freed from your infirmity. And the old ruler of the synagogue stood up and said, "I have an announcement to make." He said, "There are 6 days in which work ought to be done. You come on those days to be healed and not on the Sabbath." Oh, that was the wrong answer. That was the wrong answer. Jesus said, "You hypocrite. You hypocrite, which of you having an ox or an ass won't loose him on the Sabbath day and lead him away to water? Should not this daughter of Abraham, whom Satan has bound low these 18 years, be healed on the Sabbath day?" And it said all of his adversaries were put to shame. Well, I should think they should be. But it said all the people glorified God in it. And you could just hear them say, "Go, Jesus, go! Do it again! Hallelujah!" You can see the whole congregation of the common people say, "Praise the Lord! That makes sense! We do loose our ox or our ass. We loose it and we need the water. I hadn't thought about it, but we do that. And it makes sense for this poor woman to be loosed who's been bound for 18 long years. That doesn't make sense to do one and not allow the other." Oh, it makes you search your heart when you think about the traditions we have sometimes and you think, you know, that really doesn't make all that much sense. Think about it. That's when they were confronted by Jesus of Nazareth. They began to make the plans to get rid of him.